But I had a PowerPoint, right, so I could have done it that way, but this was easier. So these are the five stages that we've talked about over the course of the week, categorized by, if I can just remind you, what these letters stand for, how people think of the stages, how they feel, what their needs are, how they deploy power or get those needs met, to what they are committed, and what the gospel or what the promise should be at this stage.
Is there anyone here who hasn't been here before? I'm just
gonna... Yeah, I haven't been here at all. All right. So I'm trying to lay out a particular model of humor that I try to use with adults, but to suggest that we get caught up in different stages of our development for particular reasons. We would all like to be generative in our way of engaging the world, and I can share a little bit what generative is. But often we find ourselves operating on some of these later stages, because all the stages are in us, because we develop through them, and we develop kind of mobile. They build upon one another. Right? So when you're, I'm sorry to do this to the rest of you, but I'll go very quickly. So for example, have you been here before?
Yes.
Okay. So you're the only one that hasn't been. But I feel like I have. So enforcer is roughly 0 to 3 years of age. And a scorekeeper is 4 to 10. Peacemaker is 11 to 15. Rebel producer is late adolescence, early adulthood, and generative is full adulthood. And the idea is that we expand our capacities and build upon the things that we've been able to achieve in an earlier stage. And a lot of this is just part of the nature of things. Children just go through these stages almost whether we like it or not. Now, it is true that, say, if these children in Russia or China who are put in orphanages and receive no sort of human interaction, they find it hard to even make some of these basic stages. They may never learn to speak, for example. But in general, children learn over time without a lot of effort. They just go through these stages. But once you get to about 21, the development requires a continued effort. And that is, in fact, why we have things like spiritual direction, therapy, and other sort of modes of forming oneself or developing oneself. So this is how we think, and I show how thinking changes over the life course, right? So children think episodically. Infants think episodically. So it's in their mind. They have the thought. They find it very hard to connect thoughts one to another. So they have no sense yet of time. And in fact, there's a collapsing of their identity into the identity of usually the mother. So it takes time even to differentiate the baby from the breast. They think, hey, that's me. And it's actually the first sort of differentiation is when the breast is not always available. Oh, hang on, maybe that's not me, because if that was me, it would be here right now. And it's not. So you start to get the sense of differentiation over time. And so these are just broad categories, 0 to 3. So their thinking is episodic. Their feelings are immediate and basic. Right? They have a feeling, and then it's over. Their basic need is safety and survival. And how they get it is they either fight for it, so they'll rage and scream. They'll shut down completely, they'll walk away or fall asleep. An infant actually, if you let it cry long enough, it gives up and falls asleep. Or, you know, to the extent that another need they might have is joy, or they will play. So these are strategies, how they deploy their power or get their needs met. What are they committed to? Their commitment is not very deep because they don't have the concept of time. And commitment generally involves some notion of pledging oneself to a future. But they are committed to what I call the sources of life. This is evolving every day. And then somebody asked us, well, what would gospel look like at this stage? And I would say, that God creation has everything you need. Right? Your survival, your safety, you've got that covered. So score keeping, this is 4 to 10. Here, it's concrete literal kind of thinking. So If you have a child or remember being at this stage, you probably can relate to this notion of concrete literal thinking. Not very good at metaphor yet, but you know. My 3-year-old daughter, it's a little bit episodic going towards concrete literal. She has three times, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So yesterday is anything that happened in the past, today is what's going on now, and tomorrow is the future. So she'll say, is it tomorrow yet? Yeah. So it's hard for me to explain yet that, well, when it's tomorrow, it won't be tomorrow, it'll be today. It's a little confusing. Okay, so we go to the next, these kids, 4 to 10, their feelings, they feel pretty needy and resentful at times. So it's a little more sophisticated emotion than just rage and joy, which is basically, I think it's on and off for a 0 to 3. And you know, parents with more experience can tell me I'm wrong. What they fundamentally need is a sense of value and worth, and how they deploy power as they negotiate. Well, how can I go to bed at 8:30? No. 8:15? No. 8 o'clock? No. Usually I actually give in at 8:15. They also start to deceive and dissemble and trick, okay, to get what they want. And they're committed to fairness, to the notion of fairness, and to their own ends. And I think that one way, the gospel here is that, you know, since the gospel is a response to the need, so God loves you. You have worth. You're valuable. This is what we want to give our children. So peacemaking, uncritical abstract thinking, feeling, often self-conscious and embarrassed. Remember, this is when you're 13 and your hormones are raging and your body's changing, and you just wanted was fit in. So, and maybe I'm just projecting. But you feel a deep responsibility for other people, but not necessarily to them, but for them. Your great need in this is belonging. And you negotiate with people, not negotiate with them, but you oblige them. But you have to do this. You're my best friend. Right? Or so there's a sense of capitalizing on other people's desire for you to like them. You capitalize on it. And then you're committed to what is right, right? So there's a sense of, or peer standards. Maybe not the greatest good, but the greater good, but you're committed to the good of the group. And I was thinking, if the need is belonging, you are part of God's body. And again, we talked about this before, but membership in the church often happens at this stage. Rebel production, this is late adolescence, early adulthood. The thinking is dichotomous, either or, and usually I'm right and you're wrong. So this is when parents don't know anything. And sometimes not managing professors, they can be very excited about a new thing, and they become kind of prophetic in their own way. Their feelings, they can be negatively impatient and superior towards other people, but they also can feel confident. Because their basic need is to learn and experience themselves as competent agents in the world. So confidence and autonomy are the needs. The way they deploy power is by getting results, by establishing expertise, developing skills, ability, and knowledge. So again, we can think about an educational process. We're getting people starting to think about their careers and getting them involved in gaining the particular kinds of expertise that will make them confident in the world. They're committed to solving problems and establishing their own competency. And I'm just thinking about this as I wrote it up, but I thought, you know, if you can find a role for people at this stage in God's community, right? So we're starting to look for leadership possibilities for them, I think is a good way of speaking gospel to them. So they're not just part of the community, but they have a vital role to play. Okay, all that was by way of review, and I apologize. This is the last stage, which is also by way of review, because we did it on the very first day. I started by getting people to reflect on what are they like at their best. And we captured some of those words, and then these are just how they came up. Thinking is dialectical and self-reflective. You're able now to take the perspective of other people, right? And which is an advancement over the rebel producer, the young adult who's got his way or her way. It's harder for them to to take the to assume the position of another person, to think the way they might think. So you're able to take multiple perspectives. Feelings, they're empathic, right? They're much more able to have empathy. And again, generative is, we think in the life cycle, it's generally the age at which, at least historically, we started to settle and have families, right? To generate, right? The new generation, to get out of ourself and get into this larger project. And not only that, it's when we start to build institutions, become part of institutions. We're no longer training to be in an institution. We're actually becoming the custodian of that institution, whether it's the church, the family, educational institutions. So also on feelings, there's a sense of congruency if you are operating out of a generative stage, that what you're feeling and what people are getting from you are the same thing. So people aren't feeling manipulated or deceived by your emotions. When you cry, you mean it. It's not like, you know, sometimes my kid cries and then looks out of the corner of her eye. So there's a congruence between emotion and inner emotion and outer emotion. The need that you have at this stage of life is that your life would be meaningful and purposeful. So it's a little bit different from competency. And the way you deploy power is you accept what's really real. So whether that's about you, that I have these gifts and these limitations, and I'm clear about that. And also, how you deploy power through collaboration. You're much more likely to be part of a team and not insist on doing it your own way. Double producers tend to be dismissive, and they say, "Oh, give it to me. I'll do it." You know, so they're terrible managers, because in fact they tell you what to do and then they go in and tell you why you didn't do it right and take it back and try to do it themselves. Commitment. They're committed to doing or saying what needs to be done or said when it needs to be done. It's a little complicated, but which is mainly to say they're committed to the issue in the moment, to dealing with it. And this is how I know I'm not generative, because I'm real time commitment. You know what? If someone says something to me and it triggers me, because I'm a peacekeeper, I'm very unlikely to say, "When you said that, it bothered me. I'll take another tack. I'll sulk." Or, you know, something. That's just one option. I'll give you the full range of my options later. You know, when you're really confident about your position in the situation, you're more likely to really address a conflict head on, or a crisis head on, and not run away or hide in your niceness or you know, berate somebody or scream and yell. Okay, so gospel. I think what would be gospel is, at least that I thought, was thinking myself, if meaning and purpose is what's up, that you are an agent in God's activity. Not just a member of the church, but or even a leader, but you're actually an agent in what God is doing in the world. And so your purpose and God's purpose can go together. So that's the whole Monty. Right? The whole Monty. Are there any questions that I could answer before I move to the next? Yes.
Did you talk at all about how this is different for males and females, or is it different?
Well, in developmental stage theory, I think it's different in a couple of ways. I mean, one of the ways that we go through these stages is through the institutions in our society, right? So you can, I've said this before, if you look at the way we educate children, we tend to break it at these stages. You know, this is really preschool, this is elementary school, middle school, high school, and college. But I think it's also true that we expect different women, men and women, for example, to be the custodians of different institutional orders. In my own experience, I had a degree in elementary education, and I was a fish out of water in an elementary school. I felt that way, as a guy. Right? But you can't hug the children. You know, the women could hug the children, but I couldn't hug the children for all these, you know, legitimate worries. So there's this sense that women are custodians of our caretaking, and you know, men are the custodians of our business enterprises. That's really collapsing. But that's a kind of traditional gender.
Women can't hug the children anymore either.
Women can't hug them either.
I mean, also the elementary school, there are some studies that are showing that that boys have trouble in elementary school, in school, because it's a female institution. So it's not just the adult men, male teachers, it's little boys too.
This right. is true.
Yeah.
That's why the true. Male teachers need to be there. Mm-hmm. And ignore those old ladies if it's old ladies who are doing it.
Right. If you can just do your thing.
Well, it was the principal, actually.
Well, she said she's called me and she said, the fact is, you know, every one of my male teachers has been charged with sexual impropriety.
Oh my gosh.
Now, she only had 3 male teachers, but so that's what you're going to face. But that's another story. But I do think that, you know, in the generative stage, there's a kind of collapsing of these differences that both men and women, I mean, I don't think there's a gender difference at generative. But it is true that, I mean, one of the reasons my default mode, as I said, is peacemaker is part of my familial story. And my wife goes to Rebel Producer, where in a stereotypical account, men go straight up, but we go Rebel Producer, and women go to peacemaker. But she's the eldest child of 3, and her father called her son, because he didn't have any sons, he has 3 daughters. So she was the son, and she was the eldest. So she became the Rebel Producer. I'm one of 5. I'm the only son, 4 sisters, and I'm the youngest. I became the caretaker of all the and also my sisters, and there was a lot of conflict with them, so I became the caretaker of emotion. Okay. So, you know, I think in general terms, it's kind of a gender division, but it plays out differently in different families.
No, go ahead. You were.
Well, I was going to ask you actually. So I wonder if you think that, or any of you, but I know Chris is a pastor. Think that, you know, that men who end up in ministry tend to be more feminized. If I can use that gross stereotype. You know, they tend to be caretakers. I don't know. What do you think?
No, just some.
Just some. Just the ones in. Good churches.
Well, actually, men in the ministry often tend to be introverts. I don't know how that relates to all of that, but you know, a lot of in our tradition, there isn't kind of the most, I don't know, the study tradition where you can be a study person. If you love to study and you love, you know, the Bible and so on, you may go into the ministry and then discover that actually it's quite a people profession. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the issues in pastoral training. Has been, at least,
yeah.
In pastoral education.
Well, I mean, different churches and at different times and different sizes need different things.
Right, I was thinking that, you know, an executive pastor often needs a different set of skills than the pastor of a small church.
And if you have more than one pastor, hopefully you'll get different skills in each one, so they complement.
Uh-huh. So now I've sort of laid out this general schema of development. I want to talk about our unique relationship to it, because in fact, we don't all just march through this in the same way. And so I want to talk about what I call, so this is the developmental model, and I map onto that what I call script model, which is more psychodynamic or particular to your unique narrative, right? Our scripts, I think, give us some indication, like I told you a little bit of my script, gives you an indication of where you tend to go when you are triggered. Right? So when you're less than generative, where do you tend to go? And that is, I think, related to our particular unique scripts that I want to talk a little bit about. But I should say that we're most likely to be triggered when we're tired, overworked, or anxious. But we also get tripped when we experience something that reminds us of a core pain or core issue that we that there's still a lot of energy around. So that's why I think that our unique scripts can tell us something about where we are likely to get derailed. So what are scripts? They're the stories that shape the way we engage our world, ourselves, and other people. I talked a little bit about this before, but human beings are unique among creatures because we are as Peter Berger says, unfinished at birth. So we come into the world with no, very little instinctual scripts. Other animals come in knowing how to behave. They know, the monarch knows where to go, right? But the baby really doesn't, and depends upon culture, cultural scripts, to guide their life. So one of the stories and narratives and scripts that we have taken on as we grow up. Some of these are formalized in education, but my therapeutic interests are these deep stories that we take on, not through they're almost unconsciously absorbed. Right? We pick them up through the interactions of our family life.
Like the eldest child?
Sure. Where your family position is one, then it's one issue that contains all kinds of assumptions. And it tells the kids something about themselves without ever even speaking it. So I'm trying to get,
Well, so it makes me think that family systems has to connect with this somehow, with the script aspect, because the reason that I react the way I do has everything to do with the dynamics of my family, and you pointed to that in terms of the sibling order and that kind of thing. So there's a sort of defining in community or defining in relationship that influences the way in which this plays out.
Right.
Is that
right? That's where I want to go.
Oh, okay.
Although I probably wouldn't have, I don't draw on family systems so much as just psychotherapeutic. But family of origin stuff. But
yeah.
It's similar.
Yeah.
But I want to say that our scripts are made up of core beliefs. Right? And these beliefs are laid down early in us and aren't just ideas, but have a kind of emotional resonance to them. They have a depth to them that guide the way we behave in the world. So these beliefs could be such as things like, I can do it if I try. What were some of the ones? What were some of the sort of key storylines here that you picked up from your parents or from your family as a young child?
You can't do that. You're a girl.
Okay, that's a great one. Any other?
You work hard to succeed.
You work hard to succeed. Any others? Well, some of the more negative ones might be, be careful because other people are out to take advantage of you. Or people are undependable. Let's say you're a young child and there's the real threat or possibility of abandonment by one of your parents. Yeah. Then you go, I think it's natural that you go through the life thinking that the world is not a safe place. In fact, that maybe even the safety and survival of your family was at stake. And then it's easy that when you get triggered, if something comes up, that you revert to that kind of stage. Or maybe your father was an ass and called your mother nasty things and you. So the question about your worth and value could be made more vulnerable than for other folks.
I don't have like a catchy phrase for that though. I can totally relate to that, but it's not like I wouldn't say like you you can't do that because you're a boy or you're a girl.
Right.
Is there a catchy phrase for that? Just a
for the one
you just described. Yeah, your dad is an ass, calls people names.
The one I think of for myself is survivor.
Yeah.
You are a survivor.
Yes.
Because you need to be.
Yes.
Right. Well, okay, so there are these core beliefs about the world, and then we can act on them in different ways. So let's say your mother is, or father, I don't want to pick on anyone gender, is undependable. You could decide that the world is undependable, but you could also decide that I'm going to be a really dependable parent. So we make certain decisions based upon core beliefs about the world. But these core beliefs shape us in very, I think, unique ways. That I believe something more deeply about the world than you do. You may think, that's a reasonable thing, but it doesn't have the same kind of emotional weight to you because of your experience growing up. So I'm not going to write on that. But basically, I want to suggest that you have we filter our experience through a couple of things. One, we filter it through our developmental stage. Right? So we only have a certain ability to think at a particular stage. Right? But we also filter it through the beliefs that we have taken in and on as a very young child. So if you believe in some way that you are insufficient, you are not enough, then every piece of data that comes in, you experience this way. And it, I will say, you know, I coach people, it's uncanny how the same story, you know, one of the strategies I use, I get them, I say, okay, tell me about an issue you're having with somebody. And then I get them to play both sides. So I say, okay, someone's sitting here, and, okay, so I'll do it for you. So the person there, and okay, so I say, okay, so I'm having a problem with my registrar. Yeah, not that big a deal. And you start, you say, okay, tell them what the problem is. Well, you don't listen to me when I talk. And why is that? And then you switch them around, and the registrar has to talk back to them. Well, the projection that people give to the registrar is fascinating. It's part of their own story. You have no idea what that registrar is actually thinking about you. But you import or project onto them because you have these core beliefs about yourself. You believe that they think you are incompetent or stupid or lazy. But it may not even be true. But you come in with these core assumptions, and it's when I do this with people, you find, okay, then the next week they come in with a different conflict, but it's the same dynamic, the same set of assumptions that they share with someone else. And that would be actually unlikely. So I also experience it in my own relationship, right? Same with my spouse. She'll say, well, yeah, okay, maybe, but maybe you're just projecting that onto me. because actually, I'm not your mother. So there's these two things, as we bring it, interpret or receive experience in the world, and one is we through the grid of our conceptions, our beliefs about ourselves and the world, and the other is through the very capabilities we have as a thinking being. So as these expand, right, we can take in more and more of the world. A 0 to 3-year-old can only take in so much. Can only process experience in so much. Someone at a piece, they're able to abstract now, they're able to make analogies, but they're not able to do it in quite the same way that this person can or this person can. They can't be perspectival or self-reflected in quite the same way. So that the range of the world is smaller. What experience means is smaller, and this is a story of ever expanding possibility. So that we have, and then, yes?
Do people get stuck, or do they move on and move back? You know, if you see somebody or yourself in one of these, have you always been there?
Yeah, I think people develop pretty naturally through, at least to here, and generally develop naturally through here, but it's hard to maintain this.
Yeah.
And so they go back. Yeah. I wanted to remind me of the activity I wanted to do but forgot to do. And that is that in each stage we pull something both negative and positive forward. Right? And that goes into our backpack as we go through life. So this seems like a fairly negative mode of being an enforcer.
The play piece is fabulous.
Okay, so the play piece, what else might be a positive thing to pull forward?
Well, I mean, being able to tell when you're in danger.
Yeah.
Right.
And being able to react to it, recognizing danger and being able to react to it. You know, there are people who really just don't get that. You know, they don't have that ability to sense when they really are in trouble and they need to just cut the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think having these feelings is really immediate.
Yeah.
The initial transparent.
Right.
You may not, I mean, the things that cause it a little more negative, but to have those feelings be really immediate and apparent and communicate those truthfully to everyone around you.
Yeah, I think that's something that I thought about too. In the generative stage, if you can be, well, when you're an adult, if you can have the kind of transparency of a child mm-hmm. around there, you know when you're pissed off, you know when you're happy, people don't have to be trying to, suss it out. Yeah, I think that's a positive thing. Is there anything else that
But even if it's more simple than that, even if you're just cranky because you're hungry and you feed yourself so that you can move on to the next thing.
I mean, there's adults who even miss that basic part.
There are, but and certainly the abundance of God's creation.
Right.
I think the immediateness. We get too involved with the future, the past. And then the Bible says we should be like children. It must be the immediateness.
There's not a lot of worry and stress at that point. This might not happen, or this might happen. It's just either it happens or doesn't.
Yeah, I experienced my own 3-year-old with it. She lets things go. She's furious, and then lets it go. Or I nurse it. So yeah, I think those are things that we bring for. Now, in terms of the negative kinds of things that we might see in enforcer behavior that we wouldn't as an adult, if we brought those forward, that we might be a little bit worried about, is rage.
Yeah. Everything's a threat.
Yeah, everything's a threat. When it's appropriate, when things really are a threat, you need to have, I've talked about this too before, you need your thinking to be episodic when the bear steps in your path. Yeah, you need to be thinking, what should I do right now? Not, I wonder what that bear is thinking, and you know, I'm an environmentalist, I shouldn't, you know, be mean to that bear. Whatever. I mean, you have to have episodic thinking. So there is, I think this is the point that was made earlier, that you know, sometimes safety and survival really is the stake, and you need to be able to think that. Okay, so let's move to scorekeeper, and what would we want to bring forward here? I do this because a friend of mine, who I'm spending the week with, said, you know, I'm a scorekeeper, I felt really judged by this. And I think, no, you're not actually a scorekeeper, but there's something that you see in that that's really valuable, and that he heard me is just criticizing it, so I wanted to do this. So think, what would be something to pull forward from a scorekeeper?
Well, I mean, they're truth tellers in a way. You know, this isn't fair. This,
okay.
You know, this these people are getting all the goods, and these people are doing all the work.
Yeah.
Justice has to.
Yeah.
But I think having a strong sense of self-worth.
Okay.
And valuing yourself and making sure that other people feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
To say, no, I am worthwhile, and this is why. And
I think sometimes there's sort of how you layer your own individual cultural background on top of that. And what for me, I think I do have a pretty, I like to have that self-worth. I want people to value me, but then if someone comes up and compliments me openly, I have a hard time dealing with that because I've come from this like uber Norwegian background where, you know, we're all just sober and quiet, whatever, you know. But deep inside me, even though I'm not reacting, I'm really glad that that person is paying me a compliment or whatever it is.
Right.
And I think the negotiation is good. I mean, it kind of turned into collaboration at the other end. So just a...
Yeah, that is a skill that we'll need throughout our life. That you learn at this stage.
Well, sometimes it's important to get very concrete and get very literal.
Mm-hmm.
It can be so cerebral and intellectual, but sometimes it is about who has good food and who doesn't have good food. Mm-hmm. Or if we get lost in rationalization as opposed to a certain level of reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay, I don't like to keep going to my own marriage, but... I mean, if you can just be straight, concrete, literal about what you need, you know, instead of, well, you know, you should be able to figure that out. We've been married 13 years. Sort of this concrete, literal, I think that helps in some ways in communication. But the thing that brought up to my friend, I think, is this notion of justice and fairness, too. You know, you're learning those skills. And it is, he was arguing with me, and we had two kids, and they were in the pool. They're both 8, 7. No, they're both 8. I mean, they were just, I was like, this is my whole argument right here. They were having us, you stay on this side of the pool, I'll stay on this side of the pool, and going back and forth, you know, and then finally we made them, you know, separate, and then they said, well, we apologize to one another, can we get back in the pool? And we said, yes, and then my daughter said, I apologize first. So, you know, it's just a constant scorching, constant. Just trying to be great. Okay, but so you can pull some of those forward. But what about in peacemaking? What would you want to pull forward?
We care about others.
Mm-hmm.
their own okayness and take some responsibility for it, be engaged in what can I do to improve the situation.
But then that sense of belonging and being part of a group.
I think obligation to be, too. You know, a lot of folks have tremendous loyalty to a certain set of core values or groups or organizations or whatever. And I think that you know, the peacemakers having the value and the obligation and duty can very much link into shaping people as they move forward in their lives.
Well, a lot of times at that age, too, it's for a cause. They really have an obligation to this cause or this club, this group, this activity.
Where in all of this is the kind of class A person, you know, you do the right thing, you'll come out okay, and it's not really a commitment to the others, but it's kind of like this. And me being a type A person, I don't think that's such a bad thing. But I don't think of it as being, you know, self-conscious, embarrassed. I mean, it gets tied up in that adolescent piece. But if there's something in this of, you know, commitment to a cause, almost like, you know, just tell me I'm doing a good job and I'll just keep doing it. You know, that's not a bad thing at times in your life where you need to just kind of power through whatever has to get done.
To me, that resonates more with rebel producer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that. I don't get that. Maybe I'm not understanding the account, but Catholic.
Or maybe it's a little rigid. That's a possibility that I'm willing to entertain.
I really have a little trouble with saying that age group is uncritical. I mean, I substituted junior high schools, and I don't perceive them as very uncritical.
Right.
I disputed that yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm on the board.
Oh,
a
different
interpretation. Yeah, I guess I'll just say what I said. I think I said yesterday.
Come back in 5 years and see what you got to say.
Yeah.
is it maybe that there are critical of people in their own group, but critical of people outside of it?
Yeah, but think about, you know, you didn't wear the right shoes today.
Well, no, I think what I mean by uncritical here is self-criticism. They don't yet have an ability to look upon themselves self-reflectively, eventually. They look upon themselves only as the others around them look upon themselves. So
yeah,
there is this, there's an impartial spectator, but it's not an autonomous ego. It is, in fact, the group. So what will, this is actually where I think they start to dress alike and they start to care about fashion, because it's what do my peers, that's what they're always thinking, what do my peers think about me? And here, at Rebel Producer, they really want to start thinking, no, what's my own view on this? And that usually means that they differentiate themselves from it.
The peacemaker, they think everybody's looking at them all the time.
Right.
You know, I think of my daughter when she's at that age, and she's, oh, I'm so ugly, I can't go outside looking like this.
Right.
Nobody's ugly, you know?
Right, yeah.
I think the difference is critical as a verb versus critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Criticism
is the peacemaker, where critical thinking is more the rebel producer or not.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at.
They're capable of criticism, not capable of critical thinking.
That's true.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, so then we go to rebel producer. Okay, so I'm sorry. So here the problem is, the good thing is belonging. And actually, Chris, I was thinking about the conversation we had last night in our chalet about what is one's relationship to the church. Once you've kind of gone, you become a rebel producer, and you know, you don't want to be part of any club. I think it's generative relationship to the church, and you kind of come back to it. And you know, one of my wise counselor says it's the difference between being a kid and having one, right? You know, in your 20s, typically you don't go to church, and you come back to church once you have children. It's not an unusual pattern for a sociologist to observe. But more to the point, I mean, that this notion of belonging in a generative form, if you just belong in a kind of peacekeeping form, right, this actually justifies, I've said this before too, but this justifies all kinds of violence in the world. So the Nazi defense in the Nuremberg trial was, I was doing my job. You know, I was just doing what I was supposed to do. So there's no critique of tradition yet. And the need for belonging is so powerful that you're willing to do a lot of things that you shouldn't do.
But and you have to create an us and them mentality too, because if I belong, I belong to something, and then there must be somebody on the outside of that.
But I want to suggest that in all these ways, these things can, there's a generative way of doing that. There's a generative way of belonging, I think, that doesn't exclude other people. And I hear it at Holden Village all the time. You know, you're very Lutheran, right? But in the discussions, like the pastor, he talks about it's a very open. So at the same, well, there's this deep commitment and deep sense of belonging. It's not an exclusionary. It doesn't depend upon other people being bad or other, which I, as an outsider, I really appreciate. So that again says there's another way of belonging. But we can see if one gets constricted in one's sense of belonging, and as one might be at this age, then you are liable to do things that are less than fully mature. What would we want to bring forward? Well, I want to bring forward some competence and expertise.
We have a lot.
Into the world so that I can be a better agent. But I don't want that to be all that it's about, me and my expertise, look how smart I am. And, you know, I mean, if you've been with pastors or facilitators or anybody in a leadership position, you can sometimes differentiate when they're doing it for their own ego needs and when they're doing it to be an agent in the world. So there's this different way, it's almost a different relationship that one has to one's own competencies.
Yeah, that piece, the feeling is impatient, superior, confident, it almost comes because they don't feel superior, confident. They're wanting to, so they're, you know, kind of
overcome. That's an interesting way of thinking about triggering and going back to it, because if you look at it as people are developing, maybe they do feel impatient or superior. I know I did at that time. But then other times when I go back to it, it's more when I'm not quite sure that I am right, but, you know, by gosh, if I open myself up to another view, I could be really, really wrong and, you know, and challenged, so.
Don't let them see you sweat, is it? Don't let them see you sweat.
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, by gosh, it's the way I've done it. It's, you know, I'm right and you're wrong. And,
Anything else that you would want to pull into your knapsack to go into your life going forward from rebel producing?
Commitment to solving problems is kind of a big thing.
And if that's really an idealistic stage, too. You know, and the enthusiasm when somebody finds an ideal sometimes is lost later on when they're disillusioned. But it would be nice to be able to keep that piece of it.
Which I think is the twisted little gift of impatience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That energy that comes with the impatience, like, let the kingdom come now.
That's what overcomes inertia. But we need some of these people in our thinking to bother us off our stuck places.
Well, it is what I mourn, the loss of that kind of enthusiasm and naive confidence.
Yeah.
So I often wish I had some of that back. and you move me to my next point. Wait, what was the term you used? The
twisted gift.
Twisted gift. So I want to say, going back to the discussion of our scripts, right? We take on these beliefs about ourselves, and I want to say that these beliefs aren't neutral. They have emotional content. Their values are attached to them. So these deep beliefs that we have about ourselves create a kind of person, a kind of characteristic disposition that we take in the world. So I set up this conversation, I tried to say that, you know, this disposition is brought into every relationship. And that's why we seem to keep coming back to the same, we marry the same people twice or three times. Or, you know, we have the same conflicts with our friends. It's, in some ways, we're bringing something that may not be there into it. Or at least we're eliciting from them, right, a particular kind of thing, because we're particularly attentive for certain things. I'm really listening for certain kinds of judgments. Other kinds of judgments that people may fire at me, they go right over my head, and I'm but I'm really sensitive to certain kinds of judgments because of my particular script story. I'm sorry, what's your name?
April.
So April got a notion of this twist, that there's actually the good news is that there's a giftedness in this, because it's precisely where we become most self-defensive, or, you know, where our greatest pain is also where our greatest giftedness is. So we're most likely to get tripped by our unmet need, but we're also most likely to be able to meet other people's needs around that issue, right? So if my issue was, you know, a belonging or worth, when things go badly, I'm likely to resort to those kinds of behaviors. But when things are going well, I'm particularly attentive to other people's needs for belonging or worth. So our very giftedness comes out of what I call our self-protective profile, or our self-protective ways of being in the world. But I do want to hold up again this uncanny observation that we repeat patterns of behavior over and over in the world. And the problem with self-protective behaviors is that this is what we did as a child to make sure that we didn't feel that pain. So if it was about self-worth, and I was going to say, purpose of an example, we grew up thinking that we were stupid. That one reaction to that is to really prove that we're not stupid. But that every little thing along the way, so we become an A student, but we get an A minus, and we have this sense that, oh, see, it's true, I am stupid. And nobody else believes that about you, but it triggers this kind of basic story about yourself. And then you start to present yourself as stupid in the world to other people, and they believe it in some ways. And so it's our very self-defensive behavior creates the kind of response from other people. Because in a way, we're telling them how we are. But the opposite of that is that I think that people can then, it's also a source of our greatest giftedness.
How do we discover what our scripts are?
Having
these conversations, is that what you're saying? Is that the diagnostic kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I have a method that I use. which is what therapy does, or probably spiritual counseling or spiritual direction. But, it's really interesting to me. Okay, so what I ask people is, tell me about your grandparents. And, you know, I never met my grandparents, but I have a story to tell because I heard it. So there's a story. Mm-hmm. And then I say, now tell me about your parents. And then people tell a story. Again, we don't know our parents fully. We certainly don't know our grandparents fully. But there's a story that we take on and becomes part of who we are, I think. And then, you know, I try to, out of that story, I say, what are you most attentive to? What are you listening for other people to catch you out at? So, you know, I'll share a little about my story. So I'm the only son, five daughters. I was told, you are wonderful. You're the center of the universe, right? Well, that really created a sense of fraudulence. You know, so I'm always attentive to, when are people going to find out that I'm not special? Because if I say to you, you are wonderful, I think almost everyone in the room, their first response is, no. So that's my script, and that's what I'm really attentive to. When are they going to find out that I'm not special? And my self-defensiveness is to always try to present myself as special. But that just creates this greater fear that they're going to find out. And I just told you all.
So my question is, so what? What then? Now you know that, or we would discover it. So does that mean we no longer revert in the pressure situation, or do we release our generative being more, or, you know, what's the outcome of understanding?
Once you know, then what do you do with
that? Well, I do think naming it is the first step. I mean, you have to have language for it, and then it gives me a certain distance to it. I can laugh at it now in some way. I named it Billy Graham. You know, well, I'm not Billy Graham. But I get a kick out of it. You know, that my parents, that's the expectation they had. Why don't you just call me Jesus? So it gives me a distance to it. And all these things, once you are able to see then you can get curious, as I said before, not critical.
Oh,
so that's why I do that. That's why I present the way I do. And, you know, and then I try every day to think, okay, how can I present as less special and just more just trying to be an agent of God at work?
Can I toss in?
Yeah.
Well, the distance that you said it creates gives you the chance to go breathing and not just reacting, but choosing then how you want to respond. So it's not just the, this is what I always do. I recognize it. Oh, so do I want to do what I always do, or do I want to do something new? So that distance is a moment of opportunity to choose your response instead of always behaving the way you've always behaved.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, I think that goes right to what sort of my coach would say, is that you notice. If you can notice, that's what a child can't do. A child is in the grip. But when we are in the grip of one of these earlier stages, we do have this capacity to be self-reflective and notice and get ourselves out of it. Where a child, sometimes they get in a loop and they can't get out. But we do have the ability to. But if we don't take the chance, the time to notice, not in a way that's non-judgmental or non-critical, we can get locked into that. So those are a couple of things. But any other questions or responses to this stuff?
I have two things. On this personal level, I found that my work trying to figure out how I'm reactive in relationship to my family, which really relates to the dad who's an ass and fighting in my home and the whole sort of question of worth and so the scorekeeper thing, actually drives me. So I'm actually a very productive adult, partly because of this inner drive to prove my worth. And so recognizing that and recognizing the pathological roots of it was helpful in naming that. But I also am not so sad about it, because my parents saying, you can't do that, made me say, oh yeah? Right. So then that becomes part of the engine of my generativity as an adult, I think. And I've been able to be at peace about that. The second thing I want to say is more of a question to you. You can comment on my family stuff if you want to, but the new book by Robert Withnow about the emerging life period of young adulthood or emerging adulthood, sort of the, you know, this model seems to me based on the pattern 50 years ago and further ago when people graduated from college, got married, had kids, boom, they're adults. And we don't do that now. My generation and younger aren't getting married as early, they're not having kids as early, so that rebel producer generative period seems to me mapped onto how people used to go through these life stages typically. Of course, there's always exceptions, but so what do you think about that? This now period through the 20s and maybe even up to 30, where people are in extended college and graduate school, maybe married, maybe not married, for sure not having kids as quickly. Does that delay the generative moment? Is it tied to that transition, or is there some kind of other thing going on, do you think?
Well, okay, you got biographical. Well, I'll get out of biographical. We're both sociologists. And I do think that the social institutions that we live in invite us to particular stages of life, right? So, and it is, you know, sort of how this is householding, generative is householding, or as I said, custodial. I was in graduate school until I was almost 40.
Yeah.
And it is true. I never felt like a grown up.
Sonia laughed at me. I've been married to you for 10 years, Chris, and you still haven't got a proper job.
Right. So, I mean, one way that this gets elaborated is that there are some stages, right? So, you know, this, I just have five quick stages, but you can make it 10 by having A and B and generative, A and B, and you know, producer. In fact, that's what Kohlberg does. He has six stages, but he actually only has three, but he has sub-stages in each. So I do think that's true. But I also think that I try to use this as a heuristic, just so people can get.
Yeah,
certainly I get with 0 to 3, but once you get to rebel producing and generative, I do think it's elaborated over much longer.
Well, and can you be in different ones in different places in your life too, like at work or at home?
Sure, because while I was in graduate school, I also had 2 kids.
Yeah.
You know, and a wife. So yeah, it's complicated. It's made more complicated, I think, by our president. One other thing I want to say to Janice is that, you know, that it's, well, the key question is, what do I need? Because usually when we're tripped back by a need, a fundamental need. We're all, that, in this theory at least, what's at its heart are the fundamental needs that are at stake. And it is when our needs are not being met that we resort to that. And to, the way to figure out what your need is the royal road to your needs is your feelings. What am I feeling? So, you know, you ask people, what are you feeling? And then, you know, again, in a coaching or therapeutic setting, it's amazing how people find it hard to articulate what they're feeling. But you get them to articulate what they're feeling, and then you can kind of get underneath, well, what when did you feel that way before? Okay, and then when did you feel that way before? And finally, you get down to the basic need that they was unmet. And then you can decide, you know, we're grown-ups. The difference between being a child and being an adult is that we're responsible for our own needs. So find some way to get that need met. Don't wait for mom. Maybe my father's dead. You know, I'll be waiting a long time. So that's, sorry to go back to that. But I do, yeah, Chris, I believe this is, there's, we have a scientist and a sociologist in the room. So I would say to a certain degree, this is just part of nature. Mm-hmm. But after that, I think it's part of the social institution.
Well, I think, getting back to your point, as somebody who is in, I'm in my late 20s, and I'm married, but I don't have kids. But I feel like we've started nesting in other ways. We mm-hmm. have garden, and we have pets, and we're not ready for kids now. And I imagine that when we do have kids, our life will have more meaning and more purpose, but that we found other ways,
yeah.
that now there are other ways to
sure.
start that nesting process.
It's not that it doesn't happen, it's just sort of stretched out.
Yeah.
Where it happened in a more rapid, compact way.
Right. Yeah.
And still does in some communities.
You know, this being at home is really interesting because there are more people who are a married couple or a partnered couple with kids than any other group I'm in. I'm around a lot of people who are single, and I'm around a lot of people who have partners and no children. And that, you know, is much more the norm in my social group. And so, you know, this is almost like you don't grow up until you have the nest. And I think we have to be really
careful. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be heard saying
that. That's a message. Pardon?
I wouldn't want to be heard saying that.
Yeah, but there's a little bit of that message, too, that comes in church communities sometimes. Our church community tends to be different in that way, but a lot of church communities tend to be, you know, you're grown up when you are a partner, and especially when you have children. And that's not, I don't think, a very helpful message for people for whom that isn't. They're
thinking. I have been asked one time in the last 2 weeks, so how long have you guys been married? So, more times in the last 2 weeks in my entire life.
But so, the fact that we don't know how to look at that group, isn't that something to do with why we don't have very many of them in our churches?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, why you come back when you have children? Because there was no place for you in between. You know, we're off. They didn't know what to do with it.
My sister came to Holden Village a couple years ago when she was 45 and single, and she was my mom and dad who were in their 80s, and they got put together all in the same room. And she said, you know, I really don't want to spend the whole week with my mom and dad in the same room taking care of them. Mm-hmm. And she said, Mira would be fine. I'd like to be with another single person. And they said, well, we always put children with the parents. And she spent the week here.
Oh, wow.
45 years old because she was a child.
Would she consider coming back?
She did come back with my daughter, who was a teenager. But she said, I would never come alone because of that. And I would, you know, because I don't know. But it was just to her. She felt just, it was humiliating to her. All week she said, I'm 45 years old. I can be the parents of some of these adults here who are, you know. And but, I mean, they were like, they are this week full. too, and she understood that, but it just made her feel horrible. And she said, that's what, you know, society does to people.
Right.
Well, my brother and sister-in-law are about the most generative people I know. I mean, they're way more generative than I am. They are married, but they don't have children by choice, and in their church, which is quite an enlightened church, they, for a long time, they either had to be with the seniors who had gone through and no longer had children in their nest, or they were expected to be youth leaders, because here they were, you know, people, of course, they're, you know, in their 40s now, so it's not as though they and the 18-year-olds or the 13-year-olds have that much in common. But, and, you know, it was really interesting. They had to kind of say, hello, look what's happening, and they were able to step in and say that, but it was not something that it still isn't easy, you know, for that church. And so most of their friends are in their 60s and 70s and are retired people that live in their neighborhood. They just have a lot in common with them as, you know, a partnered group. It's, I said, and you put up with that? They said, well, yeah, I mean, we hear about the church. But it's pretty amazing.
That is the sort of the natural experience that way, too.
Right.
I mean, it's not often specifically put on both of them. And that's my experience here at Holden as well. I've been living here for a year and a half. I'm 45 and single. And, you know, all the other single people, they're in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're the older, divorced and retired women. You know, all the other people my age go back to their chalets in the evening with their families.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just sort of like one group or the other. And, you know.
I do think we need to find ways to give people custodial roles.
Yeah.
That's all. Parenting is an easy custodial role, right, to get. But there are other custodial roles. In our society, it's kind of a natural custodial role. There are a lot of other custodial roles.
The other group where our churches are bad at dealing with is single parents. I don't know what to do with them at all.
Well, listen, by way of preview, tomorrow I'm going to talk about a couple of sort of skill-building things or dimensions of generativity. So I want to talk about what does listening look like when one is generative? Probably focus mostly on that. A couple other sort of skill things. But did you have your hand?
Hey, that's fine.
Okay. Am I moving
into anyone can leave.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking about this point that you were making about how our place of greatest pain becomes also the place where we can discover our greatest gift. But it seems to me like the converse could be true too, like it could become the place where we're most destructive. Or
that's right.
It is.
Yeah, I guess I am.
So what makes it a place of gift rather than a place of destruction? How is it? What factors into that place of pain becoming some place where we discover a gift rather than where we?
Well, I really think I'll put my two cents in and then over. But it's about intention. What is the intention of the execution of the gift? And so if my intention here is for you all to think I'm smart or interesting or special, that may undermine, right, and actually leave you with a bad taste in your mouth. But if I have a different intention, or to the degree, let's say I have mixed intentions. So to the degree that my intention is for the glory of God or the kingdom of God, that's one thing. And then the second piece I'd say is our intentions can be informed by our own sense of God's grace.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that we have grace, so that if it wasn't for grace, I probably wouldn't get up in the morning because I would be so worried that I'm going to come at you with my needs rather than my gift. Just those two things. One is intention. What's the intention? And you can usually figure that out from someone. Well, what's their real intention here? And then the second thing is if our intentions are grounded in our sense of God's goodness rather than our own neediness. But anyone else want to take it out? Cam?
Thank you.
Thank you,
Greg.